This is Radio Freethinker, episode 73.
Welcome to Radio Freethinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher.
And I'm Chloe, the new girl.
Right. Well, alert listeners will realize that Rob is not here, nor is Daniel.
Either that or they've had some radical changes.
Who knows, right?
No, it's a different person. Okay, so much for the radical surgery.
Well, we're very happy to have with us Chloe.
Well, I am a student at the University of British Columbia, and I'm beginning creative writing, certainly. I'm a very poor writer, if that was the case. And I'm an IR minor, which sort of takes care of the other interests.
IR is?
International Relations, sorry. I'm umming.
No, it's okay. Right now, Rob is sitting there going, yo, so you want my spot, do you? Well, you just keep umming away there. And
yeah, because Rob is the person to
to be here. I like free thinking.
Yes.
There you go.
Excellent.
So today, we're going to talk about some pretty interesting topics, and later on we'll have an interview with Dr. Rachi, who is one of the reporters for the popular Skeptic Zone podcast in Australia.
So, Ethan, you know, you're a historian or anything, so has anything exciting happened this week?
In history?
Well, or of some historical note?
Well, everything.
Perhaps of an Anglo sort of angle, maybe a little roundish.
Sure, history has happened since last Tuesday.
I don't know where you're going for, but I have noticed there has been an exciting new find. In fact, it's causing quite a bit of controversy in the archaeological community, and that question is, have we found a new Stonehenge?
Boom, 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 boom. Although I didn't think it was made of stone.
Well, see, there's the first question. Archaeologists on Thursday have discovered a new monument similar to Stonehenge near the ancient stone circle. The structure is said to be a wooden version of Stonehenge, which has coined the term Timberhenge. And it is about 900 meters away from Stonehenge, thought to be a circular timber structure with two entrances, probably constructed around the same time as the stone circle, about 4,500 years ago. Now, this interesting find was actually discovered by radar. As we were sort of talking about, the area surrounding Stonehenge is vigorously protected and is extremely hard to excavate, so they had to do this by radar. And if you look online, you can see the video of this little radar being towed by a tractor across the plains of Salisbury, which is interesting. And so they find these timber poles and these big, deep, shallow graves or whatever
I've for those of you who don't know, there's a British program called Time Team. And the Brits are such bizarre people. They've had a series on for about 13, 14 years now that is it's an hour-long archaeological show. And all they talk, they say, well, today we're going to dig here and let's see what we can find, some Roman things. So I've seen this ground-penetrating radar they use. This one here, I think, is magnetic resonance is what they used on it. And yeah, they got these little funny little things. But all you see on it are little dark blotches, yeah. And they interpolate these to be interpolates word, to be holes or whatever. Although, again, if you've watched Time Team, you found, and it's hilarious the way they do this. They sit there and they say, look, we got this little brown splotch, and it looks like a square. So maybe this could be like the new cathedral of Westminster, or maybe it's an alien spaceship, or let's find out after the commercial. And you come back after the commercial, and it's like someone's doghouse or something, right? I mean, it's not always that disappointing, but I mean, the ground-penetrating radar, these magnetic resonance things, tell you that there's something there, but until you actually get to dig it up.
Yeah, that's one of the big issues. I mean, people are saying that this discovery is going to change the way we think about Stonehenge, and it's changed it a little bit, but, I mean, let's face it, we haven't excavated anything yet. We don't know what the structure was used for. There's very little information here except this sort of exciting tidbit. And, you know, the archaeological team is well aware of this. Tim Darville, a professor of archaeology at the Bournemouth University in southern England, expressed skepticism, with a K, saying he believed it is more likely a burrow or prehistoric tomb. So there's not exactly consensus that this is, you know, Stonehenge 2.0 or something.
Before we let the new person in, it's British, so I think it's skepticism with a C.
Well, he spelled it with a K.
No, so. The newspaper did.
Well, whatever. That's the point, though. It's skepticism with a K.
What are the theories for what Stonehenge was used for? Still be used for,
well,
if you believe in aliens.
Sure. currently, there's a lot of perceptions that it was built by druids, and it's sort of like this sort of astronomical location. There's not really much evidence for that. The evidence that does exist indicates that it was some kind of graveyard or burial ground, at least for the first 500 years of its existence. Getting beyond that is kind of iffy. Like, sort of as I was mentioning, Stonehenge is relatively speaking, compared to like the pyramids or anything other or major structures, we know very little about. And Stonehenge is tantalizing in that it's there, we can see it, but the evidence to make any kind of theory on it is very slim. So it's kind of teasing us through history. We know it had a purpose, we're not just quite sure how big of a discovery is this. And the answer, I think, is actually pretty big. This does give us new insight into Stonehenge, and it fits in nicely with some recenter discoveries in the last 20 years. There's been other the river, it's called Bluehenge. There's been standing stones discovered all over Britain, even into Scotland, Wales, that area as well.
According to Wiki, which of course is an absolute thing, there's 1,000 registered stone circles in the UK.
Yeah.
Most of them, though, not nearly as exciting or megalithic as the...
Stonehenge is the big famous one. It's got a velvet rope around it, so you can't get too close.
Do they follow the same general pattern of construction, or are they quite varied?
Well, they all sort of in a circle.
Well,
If you look at the way Stonehenge is laid out, and you look at sort of the what it's supposed to be, 90% of what they think is supposed to be is not there anymore.
Oh dear.
So if you look at pictures of it, you see the typical circle that we all know and love. The archaeological interpretation has about like 9.
Yeah, pictures which just haven't been preserved.
Yeah.
Although one of the other things, and according to interpretations, is it somehow related to some solar? It's a calendar or something. But that's because lots of them tend to be pointing or facing sort of in a southerly direction. But that would also make sense if you had cold northerly winds. You'd want your doors on the south side, so it could also have been a house. I know there was one archaeological thing at Durrington. It was called Durrington Hedge. For a while, now it seems to be called Durrington Wall. That was thought to be another Stonehenge type thing, but made of wood, so more a wood hedge.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things they thought was significant was it had this north-south alignment, which they thought proved that it had to be some sort of religious significance. And there are some people who still think it is. But another thing is just that, you know, that's just, it was convenient to have a south-facing window kind of thing.
Sure. I mean, again, there's really no evidence to say that it's this or that. It could be, we don't know. It's just one of those unfortunate situations where we don't have the evidence. There are no tablets or written records like there are in Egypt, unfortunately, to deal with, so.
Oh, I know how you can do it. Why don't we get one of those channelers to go in there and talk to the dead spirits? And they can tell us everything. I mean, right?
No. Well, let's not do that, actually. Well, why don't we...
On that
Yeah, it's not an amazing segue. Talking about people who are channeling things, let's channel Rob. He's doing whatever it is Rob. Skeptical Dispatch.
Dispatches from a Skeptical Traveler.
This week, I'm in Whistler, British Columbia, where they tell me that they once hosted the Winter Olympics. Really, I had no idea. It's certainly not plastered over everything in the village. Actually, never mind winter, for, as the pamphlets and guides keeping... Every... And a plethora of competing agencies... Flying tours of the treetops, to whitewater rafting, to horseback rides, bungee jumping, and ATV bear sports. To $180? As I overheard someone say the other day, sure. Mind the fact that there are a ton of free hiking and biking trails to mountain ridges, waterfalls, and lakes, with any number of affordable kayak and canoe rentals. Physical activity and athleticism is cheap, so long as you ignore the brochures. But it seems like everything in the village peddles the full experience of being a real athlete, and this is where Whistler's other reputation comes in, as a world-class wellness resort. A walk along the village stroll or a flip through any pamphlet reveals a world of spas and treatments, and it gets fairly ridiculous rather quickly. Urban lifestyles, it is a blah-bitty-blah-blah-blah. How can genuine Asian reflexology, which is hundreds of years old, be designed for... Another ad says, Whistler's many spas offer treatments from ancient... reflexology, aesthetic treatments, skincare, yoga, and Pilates. At least that one sort of increases on the effectiveness scale, but note the classic use of... The resistance of nonsense aimed at faux athleticism is just across the street from here, and it's called quantum vitamins. Yes, quantum vitamins. A completely meaningless name seemingly designed to conjure up scientific expertise in health, while actually just hawking the usual unregulated supplements under posters of body and dispensing advice which, according to a recent study, at worst. Bullshit is everywhere. Direct people free with
heard about the latest controversy. Apparently, the government is no longer caring about what you guys do at all. They're not. Apparently some people have been complaining that the Stephen Harper government is manufacturing a controversy by claiming to scrap the long form of the Canadian census. They say that he's doing this because, well, we're not talking about... scrapping the long... do. Most people do the short form. 20% of the population have to do a longer form. The difference is 7 questions, 53 questions. Now, technically, and this is where some of the issues have arisen, the mandatory form, you could be fined up to $5,000 if you don't fill in the form and you go. which of course helps you figure out if you have 20 people living in a house and you've got one bedroom, that might hint that there are some households in this country are slightly overcrowded and it might be statistical importance to those. Issues. Well, in 1871, the Canadian Census asked 211 questions. And those questions included things like land holdings, your education, your military service. They asked about commerce and industry, your age, sex, education, all sorts of different things. I mean, so the intrusive question. Although, right up until I think it's the 50s or 60s, all these were interviewed personally. So, you know, the whole idea of it being very intrusive just doesn't seem to be there. Another complaint that some people bring up, you know, the government gets all this information. You can't really trust the government stats, can you? They're bureaucrats and a lot. In the 2006 census, one of the questions they said, you can either fill out this information about your income and all that, or you tick this box and we'll just ask Revenue Canada and they'll tell us this information, right? And what was it? Almost 83% of the people ticked the box saying, sure, have at it. I don't really care. I trust you. You guys are government. Government's good. So again, I'm sitting there going, well, what is the big controversy? And it's just not a controversy in Canada. In fact, if you take a look on the internet, which is where most of our information comes from these days, it's really a huge thing in the United States, and with a particular aspect of the United States, but I'll get into that later. Although it's also being pushed in England by the Conservative Party, who plans to scrap the entire census process altogether.
Really?
But, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Which strikes me as bizarre. But so in the United States, where they also have the fine, the real big issue isn't, they don't talk a little much about the fine, although that is a big issue there, but they keep talking about, you know, how big governments they are, right? And it's unconstitutional for all their problems and such. Well, to wrap things up, I guess, because, I mean, I'm going to make a blog about this, so I'll fill in some of the details, and we got a lot in our show today. But the statistical information is really, really important. And the fact that it's a census versus a survey, which is what the government's gone to, is important because people don't fill out surveys. They feel like, it's just a survey, whatever, right? We all get inundated. Whereas a census is part of the thing. And important decisions get made by that. And relying on private companies or volunteer surveys creates huge disservices in the way things are done. According to Stats Canada, the average low wage in Canada was $6,000. According to, the Survey of Labor and Income Dynamics, it was $8,000. That's like 25% difference between the two. The average people who were in the lower class worked out to be, well, the income differences in the lower class, there was a difference of like 5%, between 11% and 60%. Again, these numbers out of context don't make much sense. There'll be a blog to fill in the details. But another thing that makes the census really important, and to finish up, is its consistency of the data. I mean, the census is created by statisticians who make sure that they get a nice random sample that is statistically significant. Surveys, you don't get that. And because they've been doing it since forever, the questions they ask are all relevant to each other. So when you compare 2000 with 1901, you can actually make a valid assessment. Whereas the other surveys, they change, some disappear, some reappear. And it's just very hard to make any kind of valid statistical judgments on it. You're shooting at the dark. And that's why statisticians don't like it, why the head of StatsCan quit, and why, I don't know why this is a controversy and why the Harper government did it, other than a smokescreen or some other vile conspiracy. But yes. I'll mention that in the blog.
Yeah, very good skeptical way to end that up on. Let's go to a commercial break. We'll be back with some more on Radio Free Thinker.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
CITR has more friends than ever before. We've partnered with tons of local businesses to bring you great discounts in the communities where you live, work, and play. Maybe Main Street is your main drag. Present your Friends of CITR card at Red Cat Records, Lucky's Comics, Devil May Wear, Thriller, Blim, The Kiss Store, The Wallflower Modern Diner, RX Comics, Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Vinyl Records, Regional Assembly of Text, and Twig and Hottie to receive fabulous discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free Friends card, and feel the love.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, Chloe, you're going to talk to us a bit about vaccines, the H1N1 vaccine, and whether or not it was worth it, whether or not it accomplished anything.
It was worth it. I didn't die. That made it worth it, right?
So
right?
I'm keeping Dawn alive. Was the H1N1 worth it?
Well, a study coming out of the University of Toronto, indicates that it was very much worth it. The headline of an article in regards to this research was entitled "Ontario's H1N1 Vaccination Plan Prevented 1 Million Deaths." Actually, they prevented 4.1 million deaths. Thank you, headline. One of the things that's very interesting about this particular study is that they talk about the cost effectiveness of this plan, and the way this is measured, I found this very interesting, is in something called Quality Adjusted Life Years (QALY), and Beat Sander, the lady who is the main researcher for this. This project said 17,000 QALYs were saved at $9,400 per QALY, bringing us to a lot of money, which was less, in fact, than the, yes, Don, you're pointing your finger at me.
those are our hidden cues. They're not supposed to know about them. But now that I've mentioned that and ruined it. So you said quality.
Quality adjusted life years.
Okay. And what is a quality adjusted life year?
Well, what is exactly? It's either the quality of life lost during the time person is sick, or the life lost if the person dies prematurely.
I know when I was doing research on this that they used that number, but they used it as sort of a percentage. So 100% would be full quality of life. This is exactly the way I want to live my life. Zero would be, well, dead. And and if you have the flu, you know, if you had influenza virus, that might diminish your quality of life by 40%. So it would be a multiplying factor of like 0.6, because you'd have 60% of your life as normal. So when I tried to jigger that with these numbers, I was kind of confused on how that worked.
Well, it's an interesting question, especially because they try and put a price tag on each of these quality adjusted life years. I'm not entirely sure how they determine this. It worries me that it might be a bit subjective, because I mean, assuming that they are scientists, I would assume that they strive for objectivity of some description. But what is interesting is that it falls. Sort of that level of cost per QALY is well below the World Health Organization's threshold for cost effectiveness. So, I mean, Sander, the lady who did the research, indicates that this is very positive news. Much better than the census news, anyway.
I'd also noticed that, again, doing research, because I am such a geek sometimes, that the WHO actually uses a slightly different measure. It's called Disabled Adjusted Life Years. And I guess because in Canada, we worry about quality of life. Mm-hmm. Whereas the WHO, which has a more global perspective, thinks most people die. So it has maybe it's a more negative thing. But I noticed they use this DALY, daily number. And then they multiply that with the GDP. So, because you need a number somewhere. And they say that, you know, the average GDP for a country is X. Mm-hmm. And it's cost effective if it's three times the GDP per capita of it. It's really effective if it's one or less. Mm-hmm. And anything more than three, you're starting to sit there and say, and maybe that's where some of these numbers are coming from. But it seems a little bit apples and oranges. But I mean, at least it does put some quantifiable number to it.
Yeah, and I think this particular study highlights how difficult it is to put a quantifiable number on human life. I mean, I imagine there are many people who are very uncomfortable with that notion. So it's interesting to see that people who make the decisions about our healthcare are attaching numbers to.
So then the flu vaccine, it was worth the time, energy, and cost.
In Ontario.
Okay. Can this be apply to the rest of Canada?
Well, I checked out the BC government's website. They don't seem to be very anxious about the H1N1 outbreaks in BC anymore. In fact, the adjuvanted vaccine supply expired on May 31st. So basically, if you live in BC, your vaccine is not there. I mean, you can get sick and you can one, but 42%. I don't. The overreaction to the H1 outbreak is certainly a very interesting one.
Actually, you know, I found it quite interesting because I went and I looked at that poll itself, right? And I was looking at some of the other numbers, and it being a poll, there was a lot of weird things.
Yeah.
But I thought it was really interesting that conservatives were the ones who most thought there was a lot of hype. But next to that, the place that had the most vaccinations at this point, so these were people who were vaccinated as opposed to planned to be vaccinated, was Alberta, which is sort of the heartland of conservatism. So they thought it was the most hype, but they also seemed to be the ones who were hedging their bet and being the first ones to get the vaccine, which I thought was kind of an interesting. Of course, the people who voted NDP, surprisingly enough, thought it was underplayed, that there was actually much greater danger, as well as poor people thought there was much greater danger than what everyone was going on. But those you kind of expected. But
it is interesting, though, when you think about people say it was overhyped and that it was sort of a climate of fear. But like Clay was mentioning, all those soap dispensers and all that, you know, PSAs about how to stay healthy probably had an impact, which is probably why the H1N1 wasn't as bad as it could have been.
Well, and there's also the other thing, too, is the what if, right?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe this wasn't, it's 2009 when this all happened, right? Well, if it was 1917, I think it was 1917, when you had the big pan flu after World War II, where like that's what you think. It was actually World War II, but for World War I was to see. Anyhow, where millions of people died, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, this wasn't the big one. Okay, it wasn't. But it could have been, right?
I mean, history does play a bit of a role there, I think. I mean, that could be part of the reason for our paranoia is because we do have this pandemic in our history of a flu destroying everyone more than we're destroyed in war.
I think we're just disappointed because we all read our history books and we found out about the Black Death killed like a third of Europe and we figure, you know, we just don't get good plagues like we used to.
Yeah. Darn that medical science.
People
is working very well in Ontario.
People like Bill Maher, of course, is trying to get rid of, sorry.
Well, why don't we go to another commercial break on Radio Freethinker, and we'll be back with another great interview that I did at the amazing meeting in Las Vegas with Dr. Rachey, a contributor to the Skeptic Zone podcast.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, right now, hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Bread and Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver. CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
And we're here with Radio Free Thinker live at TAM, and I'm here with Dr. Rachel Dunup.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Dr. Rachel is a reporter for the Skeptic Zone podcast.
Yep.
And has an impressive resume of battling pseudoscience in Australia. So tell us some about your famous battles you've had there.
Oh, gosh. Well, sort of my main area of interest is the anti-vaccination movement, Ethan, in Australia. And I guess we've sort of been doing that for about 2 years now. I've been a member of the Australian Skeptics Committee for around about 2 years, and I kind of kicked that off with the Australian Skeptics when I joined. And basically we have a group of people called the Australian Vaccination Network. Now, like a lot of anti-vax groups, they don't openly state they are anti-vaccination. So the name in itself, Australian Vaccination Network, doesn't immediately suggest anti-vax. And also, like other anti-vax groups, they have a public statement, or, you know, their public face is, oh, we're pro-choice, we're not anti-vax, we're pro-choice, which of course is just a deceitful way of saying that they are anti-vax, but they just don't like to say that because that's not a popular position to hold. So we have sort of been lobbying against them now for quite some time, and there's been a lot of people involved in this too. It's kind of evolved into a bit of a grassroots all over the world that are into that, and Facebook page is there to just dissect all the claims made by the AVN, and so whenever they post something or whenever they blog something, it gets reposted there and taken to pieces, right. Generally. And on top of that, we've had some really important just individuals who just got to the point where they just couldn't be bothered with these people anymore. And they submitted some complaints to our Healthcare Complaints Commission, which is kind of our health watchdog, and also to a couple of other government bodies about specifically about the fact that the AVN makes claims about vaccines that are just wrong. You know, so they're misinforming the public. They're they're potentially providing health advice that is wrong. Now we've just recently had the ACCC, which is the Healthcare Complaints Commission report, is about to be finalised. So within the next sort of couple of days, probably, we're going to know what the health bodies are going to do about the anti-vaxxers in Australia. And my feeling is that it's not going to be good for them. Mm. So if you were talking to me in 2 days' time, I could tell you more. But things are really happening. Things are really happening.
Excellent. In North America, I'm sure our listeners are familiar with the anti-vax movement as being very, very radical and quite vicious.
Mm-hmm.
Is your anti-vax movement in Australia equally as vile when it comes to criticism of themselves?
Yeah, not really. I mean, not if you're talking about, say, for example, Age of Autism, who your listeners may have heard of. That's the big American one. Last year or the year before, they posted a photograph, which was photoshopped of like a Thanksgiving dinner table set up for dinner with Steve Novella, a couple of journalists who had blogged about anti-vaxxers or written about anti-vaxxers in a not a very nice way, who had criticised them basically, with a baby on the, you know, as if they were baby eaters. And in fact, David Gorski, who is here at TAM, I was on a workshop with him yesterday, the science-based medicine workshop, and he posted that photo up because Steve Novell is in the photo, and Steve was on the workshop as well. I mean, in fact, that was quite interesting because that really backfired on Age of Autism, and even people that support them actually said, hang on, guys, that's crossing the line.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, we don't get stuff like that, but I have to say that just in the last half an hour, I found out that we have been blogged on Age of Autism Today.
Oh, Australian Skeptics. That's a badge of honor.
Yay, yeah. I know. Yeah, it's fantastic too. It's one of those blogs that's laden with all the conspiracies. You know, Big Pharma, we're shills for Big Pharma. We it's a conspiracy of us and apparently CSI.
Center for Inquiry?
Yeah, CFI, sorry, yeah. Apparently we're in cahoots with them. And they've got something to do with this.
That's great. Well. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
CFI is fantastic.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I'm so glad to be collaborating with them.
Yeah.
You know, it's the normal stuff, but it's quite funny. But, you know, of course it's wrong. But, yeah. To answer your question, they're not as vicious as what they are in North America.
Well, that's good. I understand that Australia has a TV show called Media Watch.
Yeah.
One of my co-hosts loves this show. And there's not, as far as I know, at least in Canada, there's nothing really comparable to Media Watch, and it's designed to keep the media honest. So I'm wondering, how effective is it at keeping the media honest? Is it as effective as we like to think it is, or?
It's a great show. It's actually sort of our government TV company is ABC, which is different to North America. I think ABC is public commercial.
Something.
Yeah. So that's our sort of government, public-funded TV station. And what they do is if there's something in the media that appears, they will take it to pieces and criticise it if it's wrong. Now, if you are a journalist and you appear on Media Watch, you are the laughing stock of your colleagues. Like, it's if you end up on there for something you've done, it's considered pretty bad. But in terms of the impact it has on the larger media and the way that they do their stuff, doesn't really have that much of an impact. But, you know, the funny thing about it, though, is that they do spend a lot of their time actually criticising themselves. So it's made by the ABC, and a large amount of their time is spent criticising the ABC, which is also really interesting because
it's
not just other media, it's themselves as well. So, yeah.
Excellent. Well, with any kind of sort of media watchdog, I would imagine that they tackle all kinds of issues, and I imagine the skeptics would like to see them tackle more science-based issues as well. Have they taken on homeopathy or anti-vax or
the media in general in Australia?
Yeah,
we're really, really lucky. We've got some pretty good friends in journalism who are on our side, and we've been very lucky that they've addressed quite a few science-based skeptical issues with from a science perspective and from a critical thinking perspective. So you mentioned homeopathy. We had a story a few months ago on ABC again, which is our government station. Well, there's a website in Australia that I mentioned during my talk yesterday, actually. It's a homeopathic website, and they claim that they could use homeopathy for vaccination, amongst other things, which are all completely wrong. And so somebody made a complaint to our government body, which is like the FDA, and that stuff should be an analysis of it, and they wrote back to these people and said, you've got to remove that. Shouldn't have done that. Anyway, these people that run this website said, no, we don't really want to do that. And the government doesn't do anything to enforce it. So we had a story quite recently, which was a really good story. It was pretty much a takedown of the government system and also of the homeopath, and she was interviewed. And the person who did the interview, his impression was that she was just deluded, off with the fairies, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But we also had a really, really good story on chiropractic, which came off the back of the Simon Singh case when he was sued for libel, which, of course, has been dismissed now, dropped. And that was an investigation into Australian chiropractors and whether they do similar things to what the British Chiropractic Association was doing and was criticised for by Simon Singh. And that was, again, the ABC, and the journalist went out and talked to chiropractors and you know, went and talked to neurologists and said, should this be happening? Should people's, you know, necks be getting twisted like this? So, no, we've been lucky. We've got some people on our side, yeah.
That's excellent. You've also been a staunch defender of science-based medicine when it comes to ear candles. to listeners who don't know what an ear candle is, you're going to go, what? Candle in the ear, what? Could you please explain why somebody puts a candle in their ear?
This is so mental, like. Ear candles are the most preposterous piece of alternative medicine that I've ever come across. I've seen a lot of nonsense, but this is hilarious. It's basically, they are a hollow wax tube that you stick into your ear, and then you light the far end of the candle, and you lie on your side, and you wait for it to burn down. Now, the claims made are things like it removes earwax, they don't do anything. They claim that they remove earwax, but in fact they don't. Mm-hmm. In some cases, they actually drip wax into your ear. And there have been studies done showing that people have had burst eardrums, people have had loss of hearing temporarily, have had burns inside their eardrums. In fact, one woman died, not from directly from the ear candle, but she was doing it by herself, and she set fire to her curtains, and her house burnt down.
Oh, wow.
She escaped the burning house, but she died of an asthma attack in hospital.
Ouch.
Yeah. But you guys are the only people in the world who have banned them. They are banned by Health Canada.
That's right. We have learned that many pharmacies still sell ear candles. Product, they usually take them off the shelf. Ultimately, whether or not they're going to put them back on there 10 minutes after we leave, it's hard to say. It sounds so ridiculous, but people...
Well, one of the things that... Like, if you look at a demonstration of it, what they will do to show it, to demonstrate to you that they work, is they burn them, cut open what's remaining, and you'll find it at the bottom of the candle, which was near your ear. Now, scientists bothered because that's what the ear candle people claim is your earwax. Well, guess what? It's wax from the candle. It's not wax from your ear. That's been analysed. Peer review published. To answer your question, I don't know. And it's really, I mean, it's that would apply to all kinds of alt med, you know. If people's sort of self-perception and people's experiences are very, very convincing. So if you believe that it's worked for you, that is very convincing to so many people. Mm-hmm. So you can say, look, I tried it and it worked for me, so it works.
Right.
Yeah.
Some people would argue that it's not the place of government regulation to tell somebody you can't use ear candles, for instance,
mm-hmm.
or to make a certain alternative medicine impossible to get. What is your take on that whole argument?
Well, that sort of reminds me of what's going on at the moment in the UK with the NHS, the National Health Service, where they're discussing the possibility of withdrawing all public funding from homeopathy. Currently in the UK, about 4 million quid or pounds is spent a year of public funding on homeopathy, and that includes 4 homeopathic hospitals in the UK. Now, the discussion is that they're going to pull that public funding, and so there's obviously a huge outcry from alternative medicine, you know, people saying, but we should be entitled to this, we should be allowed to have it. Well, the fact is, you're still going to be able to buy it, you'll still be able to source it, but it just won't be supported by the government, you know, the government's money. I don't care if people want to buy magic water for $20 a litre, that's fine, but it shouldn't be covered by the government. With respect to ear candles, well, I think the reason that they're banned, and I think they should remain banned, is because they're dangerous. Right. They have been demonstrated to cause harm. Homeopathy in itself, for example, doesn't directly cause harm because it's water or a sugar pill. It can cause harm if you then stop taking your conventional medicine, but it won't directly harm you. But your candles do.
Right.
I mean, I think if you look at the legislation from Health Canada, I think, and I haven't read it for a while, it says that you can use them, but only for entertainment purposes, not for medical purposes.
Interesting.
Yeah, I'd have to read it again. So I think, they were banned for use as, you know, the claims that they remove earwax, but I think you could probably still get them if you just want to burn them in your, I don't know, candle holder.
Sure, yeah. I mean, they're probably relatively easy to manufacture or just grab a normal candle.
Well, you know what else? Because I've blogged about ear candles. I blogged about it for The Zone some time ago, and in fact, that blog post has had something like 40,000 hits. It's the most popular post I've ever written. But occasionally you get the people that don't quite understand what you've written and write it and say, oh, would you like to buy some ear candles? I manufacture them. You know, I've had about three or four of those emails, and I think they cost something like 20 cents to manufacture each. And there's something like $15 Australian for two of them.
So it's definitely a way to make money.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And the day that I do turn to the dark side, I've already written my list of things I'm going to do to make money. That's one of them.
Excellent. Well, I think it's been mentioned before that skeptics can really rake in the cash, whether we decide to be cold readers or sellers of any manner of medical woo.
Well, do you see what I'm wearing on my wrist today, Ethan?
That is a power bracelet.
It's a power balance bracelet.
Ah.
Yeah, yeah.
And that balances your power?
Oh, no, it sort of aligns your energies and gives you improved balance and strength. Yeah. But these are sold in Australia for $65, and you can buy them from China for 3 cents a piece.
Wow.
That's a pretty big markup. Yeah.
Yeah, that's, yeah. So worth paying the shipping and handling, I think.
Yeah, that's on my list for when I turn bad as well.
Excellent. Well, that's good to know that you will eventually turn
bad.
Well, Dr. Reishi, thanks for joining us on Radio Free Thinker.
And, thanks very much.
Enjoy the rest of TAM.
Yeah, I'm having a ball. It's absolutely awesome. It's my first TAM.
Oh, me too.
Yeah, and so many people are saying to me, how can it be your first TAM? What do you mean it's your first TAM? Well, it is. I've just never been before, so.
Well, you are going to be busy because you have an Australian TAM coming up.
Yes, we do. Thank you for reminding me. We have TAM Oz in November this year, 26th to the 28th of November in Sydney. We have actually sold all our first release tickets, but we are currently negotiating with the venue to squash the chairs closer together so that we can maybe get some more tickets for release soon. So if any of your listeners are interested in coming, you should follow us on Twitter. That's at TAM Oz. TAM Australia, so TAM Australia, one word. Or we have a Facebook page. So if you keep an eye on those two things, you can find out when more tickets are released, if we can get some, yeah.
Excellent. And hopefully one day you will visit us in Vancouver and we can talk some more.
Yeah, and also if you wanted to read that ear candle post, that's on the Skeptic Zone website. And my blog is Skeptic's Book of Poo Poo, which is... and that's located at skepticsbook.com.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Reishi, thanks for joining us on Radio Free Thinker.
Thanks a lot.
That's awesome.
Did you not know that was the name of my blog?
CITR 101.9 FM is proud to present music from the Enchanted Evenings concert series at the Dr. Sun Yat-sen Classical Chinese Garden in Vancouver. On Friday, August 6th, CITR will be broadcasting a live performance by Silk Road Music from 7:30 till 9 p.m. Juno-nominated Silk Road Music blends classical Chinese music with modern rhythms. You can also tune in Mondays, 4 to 5 p.m., to hear performances recorded live at the Enchanted Evenings concert series. On Monday, July 26th, we'll feature music from multi-percussionist Ocean of Sound. On August 2nd, we'll have music from the Vancouver Piano Ensemble. And lastly, on August 9th, you'll hear a rebroadcast of Silk Road Music. Tune in to CITR 101.9 FM or
head along to see these performances for yourself at the Dr. Sun Yat-sen Classical Chinese Garden in downtown Vancouver. For more information, go to citr.ca.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So I wanted to thank Dr. Ritchie for that great interview, and I wanted to follow up on some of the things that we mentioned. Dr. Ritchie mentioned the complaints to the Australian Healthcare Complaints Commission about the Australian Vaccination Network, and at the time we didn't know what was going to happen with that, but since then the reports have come out, and I want to inform our listeners about them. So as of early July, the HCCC has ruled that the Australian Vaccination Network is providing misleading information about vaccination and must post disclaimers on their website that they're clearly stating that they are anti-vax, because they try to pass themselves off as sort of like this network of information about vaccines. Now, the AVN has to put on this website in some format that the Australian Vaccination Network's purpose is to provide information against vaccination in order to balance what it believes is a substantial amount of pro-vaccination information available elsewhere, and that the information provided should not be read as medical advice. And finally, the decision about whether or not to vaccinate, it should be made by a consultation with a healthcare provider. Now, this may sound like a slap on the wrist, but the negative press that the AVN has gotten because of this is absolutely amazing. Some of the headlines about this recent coup include: anti-vax group wrapped for false information, anti-vaccination group accused of harassing parents, top doctor backs disclaimer for anti-vax site, warning order for anti-vaccination website. So some of the headlines that have recently surfaced. Well, the HCC issued a press release quite recently because the AVN refused to put a disclaimer on their webpage, forcing the HCC to actually issue a public warning about them, which is awesome. The AVN was given 2 weeks to post a disclaimer. They did not. The HCCC issued a public statement, and with all the attention the AVN is getting, it's not surprising to learn that several science journals are now realizing that their content from their authors was copied and pasted onto AVN and not attributed correctly. So now they're facing copyright infringement, like legal battles. So overall, this is a tremendous win for skepticism and critical thinking, and go to the Australian skeptics like Dr. Ritchie and the Skeptic Zone for getting this amazing victory over what is essentially misinformation and incredibly dangerous advice from who knows who.
One of the things that Dr. Ritchie had said in an interview and how to explain is the idea of actual enforcement. Now, they put out the warning. Is there anything more that they can do to actually shut the site down or force them to do, fine them?
Well, I don't know too much about what the Australian system is going to be, but given the incredible amount of bad press they've been getting and the fact that they may be facing legal battles from science journals, is really flushing the reputation down the toilet. It's not quite like in North America where seems like practitioners of WHO get a free pass by the media. It seems like Australia is really taking it to them. If you go to Dr. Ritchie's blog, she's been posting some of the interviews that some of the AVN people have been doing, and they're absolutely just amazing. They're getting taken to the task. I mean, people are like trying to nail them down on their points, and they're saying things like, well, we're not really anti-vax, we're pro-choice. And they're like, oh, come on, give me a break.
Where's her blog?
Her blog is The Skeptical Book of Poo-Poo. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, which is very interesting and funny. And we'll link to that on our show notes, so I encourage you to check out us at www.radioeverythinker.com. There's one other final highlight I wanted to mention, and that is we talked briefly about ear candles and Health Canada. Well, CFI Vancouver has been doing some activism of our own, and we discovered, like I mentioned, that some pharmacies have been selling ear candles. Well, we filed a complaint with Health Canada, and we're following through with that, and it looks quite promising. So we can't really announce anything yet, but stay tuned, because we're going to have a full announcement pretty soon about the activism in that situation.
Has there been any increase in ear candle entertaining since?
I don't know. I honestly don't know what entertainment purpose you could have with ear candling. I mean, maybe like if you wanted to stage someone getting their hair caught on fire and put it on YouTube or something.
I'm imagining like an ear-oriented burlesque or something very...
Well, you know, actually I've heard too that ear candling is also used in the belly button to do a similar... It's the same woo-woo, but it's also used there because the tube is supposed to suck out the evilness. If you've got, you know, ulcers or something, it's supposed to work like that. But in the meantime, so we should... If we know that there's a pharmacy around town who has ear candling, would you recommend to our listeners to at least bring it to the attention of the pharmacy that they're
Absolutely.
Selling an illegal product?
Absolutely. Tell them that they're selling a product that Health Canada has deemed dangerous and is banned. And if they don't comply, then by all means, file a complaint with Health Canada. This is what we have health agency watchdogs for.
Now, I'm confused about one little thing here, because we had our little humor about using it for entertainment in a burlesque show with that, which will put visions in my head that shouldn't be there, but is it illegal to sell them, or is it illegal to sell them in a pharmacy, or is it illegal to, like, I mean, like so how do you delineate the two, or is it, you know,
well,
I'm kind of confused.
See, that's where I was also a little bit confused. I'm not quite sure where the entertainment factor literally factors in. As far as I understand it, it is legal to manufacture them and it is illegal to sell them because they make claims that they can't do. That's sort of the final red flag for any sort of health agency. If you say your product can do something and it can't do it, that is usually illegal, which is why most, you know, alternative medicine says things like it'll make you feel good and it won't cure your cancer, but it will make the cancer better or something, you know, like it says these very wishy-washy claims. So ultimately, I think what's going to come down to is the proactive approach of our public, skeptical public, and the, frankly, just how much the pharmacists actually care about the products they're selling.
And you know, if you really want to get on this, we sell 1 ounce bottles of rational water that will make you a more rational person for when you need that.
So only just $49.99.
Yeah, to radio.freethinker@gmail.com. You can also send any comments you have about anything we've talked about so far to that. Do we have any highlighty things?
We have highlight things. Skeptical highlights of things that you can do here in Vancouver and abroad. Upcoming this week, Friday the 30th, PZ Myers is speaking for CFI at 7 p.m. at UBC, and you can get all the details at www.cficanada.ca/Vancouver. He's also speaking in Abbotsford at the University of the Fraser Valley at noon on Friday. So if you Google PZ Myers in Vancouver and Abbotsford, they will pop up. I encourage you to go to both talks.
Now, I have one question about the PZ Myers thing. Now, it says afterwards there's a reception. What the heck is the reception? I mean, besides, like, is it like meeting the Queen? Do they give away free drugs? I mean, like,
well,
it's
there won't be drugs. There'll be I don't want to touch that issue. Actually, the reception will be taking place in a pub that CFI has rented out. It'll be all ours. You'll have appetizers provided by CFI. There'll be drinks, pop and water. We cannot provide alcohol for liability issues, but feel free to get a beer, have a beer with PZ Myers, and hang out with this really cool skeptic. There's also another interesting talk coming up, and that's by our own Rob, who is not here today, but he's giving a talk for the new Bright Lights at the Rio Theater on August 6th. So stay tuned for more information on that. We'll have all the details on RadioFreethinker.com.
What's new Bright Lights?
I assume it is some kind of talk that's going on at the Rio Theater. That's why I said stay tuned for more details, because
yes,
there'll be more on the website.
With any luck, maybe Rob will blog about it.
Yeah.
Are the people the Bright Lights, or are there Bright Lights at the Rio Theater that he would like to exhibit?
There'll be four Bright Lights.
There'll be drugs there? Maybe that's the Bright... No, sorry.
Yeah.
So
rational water, actually.
So there's going to be a little surprises to my skeptic highlight this week is Time Team, which, if you've noted, we were talking about Stonehenge. And if you go to YouTube and you look up Time Team, The Secrets of Stonehenge, it's TT/Stonehenge, and there are 8 episodes. Go on there, take a look at them. You'll be amazed at the show. Be wary, though. When you do Secrets of Stonehenge, you also get the UFO conspiracy theories, the Freemasons, and something to do with a monkey, but I wasn't quite...
Highlights for us?
I have none, I'm sorry to say. I will bring some.
Well, you're new, so it's understandable.
Did you have any recommendations about reading material?
Yes, I am reading The Blank Slate by Steven Pinker, and he is making every effort to get rid of this sort of notion of the ghost in the machine and the blank slate and the noble savage in said book, and it's quite a good read.
Excellent. Well, I encourage our listeners to check that out. Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Chloe, the new girl and new Meister.
So thanks for listening, everybody, and tune in next week on Radio Freethinker.